Aye.
We're going to call the meeting to order. One quick housekeeping thing for the members. There is, should be a blue sheet in your folders for your per diem. Please fill that out and leave it in the folder if you wish to collect your per diem for today's meeting. One other announcement. I have a school board meeting in Mankato at 4 o'clock, so about 2:15 I will be leaving, and Representative Tapke will be taking my place up here. With that, can we get started with the presentations? I'm told I'm incorrect. The blue sheet is not in the folders, and they're getting some for you. So hopefully you all get paid. Our first person up is Dr. Rebecca Schaeffler, the University of Minnesota Department of Pediatrics. Please give your name for the record when you start your presentation. Thank you.
Good afternoon, chairs and members of the committee. My name is Rebecca Schaeffler. I'm a professor in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to present today. It really is a privilege to share a snapshot of the research that I've been doing with my team for the last several years, looking at the impact of incarceration on children and families in Minnesota. Before I begin, I just want to briefly acknowledge that everything I'm going to share with you today has really been a team effort that has involved countless undergraduate and graduate students, and so I'm going to give some highlights, but there's just simply not enough time today to give shout-outs to all of them beyond that. So I was asked to give a brief overview of the research on parental incarceration, and I'm going to attempt to give you what I give undergraduate students in a whole semester-long class in about 15 minutes. So I'll try not to talk too fast, and I'm going to hit the highlights. First, I want to give you a real sense of the scope of the issue in our state, and then I want to consider a framework for thinking about how parental incarceration confers risk to children and families. And then I'm going to share a brief summary of what we know about the outcomes among children with incarcerated parents in Minnesota. So really, this first question, how many children in Minnesota have an incarcerated parent, is a pretty simple one, right? Seems relatively basic. This was a question that, not unlike other states, we couldn't answer in our state 5 years ago. The state of Minnesota, again, not like other states, doesn't systematically collect information about people who are incarcerated and whether or not they're parents with minor children. And so over the last several years, my team and I have sought to answer this question and try to get a sense of the scope of this issue through three primary data sources. The first two are surveys that our team led at the University of Minnesota. In partnership, the first was in partnership with the Department of Corrections. The second, our state survey of parents in Minnesota jails, was in partnership with the Association for Minnesota Counties and the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. And from there, we've also leveraged data from the Minnesota Student Survey, which I'm sure many members of the committee are familiar with. So the first key source of data is thinking about the state survey of parents in Minnesota prisons. As I mentioned briefly earlier, most of the states in this country do not systematically collect information about people who are incarcerated and whether or not they're parents with minor children. And so in partnership with the Minnesota Department of Corrections, we attempted to survey everybody who is coming through the Minnesota state prisons between July 2014 and December 2014, using an anonymous survey with methods very similar to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, to try to get the best snapshot, really, of how many people are moving through our state prisons that are parents with minor children. And what we found was that among men in all of our prisons, 66% of them are fathers with minor children, and among women in prison, 77% of them are mothers with minor children. You have in your packets some more detailed information about these populations and these surveys, but I want to give you some highlights here. What we know is among fathers in Minnesota prisons, more than half lived with their children, one or more of their children, before their arrest. I think this dispels many myths about incarcerated fathers that perhaps they weren't involved in their children's lives, and that's just not true. Most of these men were parenting and had an active role and were living with their minor children, and this incarceration is a disruption for that family system. About one-third of fathers in prison had a young child, which we've defined here under the age of 4. And most, about 68%, were interested in some kind of parenting class, which I think you'll hear from Commissioner Schnell and others later today is a place in our state system that is sorely needed in thinking about providing more education for the parents who want it. When we think about mothers in prison, we know that most, about 66%, lived with their children prior to their arrest. 23% had a young child. And most, again, 77%, were interested in a parenting class. Now, these data about parents in Minnesota prisons are really important, but they tell us only one piece of the puzzle. And I remember when we finished this study, several jail administrators said to me, oh, that's great, but that's not what's happening in jails, and those data don't really help us at all understand the snapshot of what's happening in jails. And of course, jails and prisons are different, and they have really important implications for child and family well-being. We know that jails hold people for short periods of time, and they have thousands of admissions every year, right? So parents are still moving through these systems, but trying to understand the scope of this issue in jails is even harder. And so it was critical to think about how are we going to employ methods, research methods, to get at the parents moving these through these systems. Again, with the prison study, we surveyed everybody who is coming through on a 6-month period of time. In the jails, because the turnover is so rapid, we couldn't use that same method. So we attempted to survey everybody who was sitting in a county jail on a given day in March 2017. We had 65 county correctional facilities participate and about 2,600 to 2,700 folks that were currently in county jails participate in that study, giving us a really representative look at the number of people who were in jails on any given day that are parents with minor children. You also have this infographic in your packet. Admittedly, it's a lot prettier in color than it is black and white, but we've got the nice copies if you ever need additional copies. What the study showed from parents in Minnesota jails is about 70% of them, 70% of men and women in county jails are parents with minor children. You can see some additional data there in terms of age and race, and we can talk a little bit more about that as we move forward. What do we know about fathers in jails? We know that 61% of them were employed prior to their arrest. 65% of fathers in jail were living with one or more of their children prior to this arrest. And 78% of them are interested in a parenting class. We see some important differences between mothers and fathers in jails. Mothers are substantially less likely to be working prior to arrest. They're just as likely to have lived with one or more of their minor children prior to their arrest. And they're slightly more likely, about 85%, to report interest in participating in a parenting class. I skipped over this for the father slide, but I'll note it briefly here. On the bottom left-hand side, you'll see some data regarding pregnancy status. You can see there that about 6% of women who are moving through county jails report that they are currently pregnant, but another 5% say that they don't know. And there's some really important implications here when we think about opportunities for early intervention. Again, we know that most of the parents who are in county jails have young children. And so again, opportunities for thinking about where do we intervene. From these data, what we know about the jail and the prison is that there are nearly 26,000 Minnesota children who have a parent in jail or prison. Some pretty staggering data when we think about this population of kids and opportunities for intervention. Another key source of data comes from the Minnesota Student Survey, and I'm not going to share too much about the background of this survey in the interest of time, but suffice it to say that this is really a key source of data on the background, school, health, out-of-school activities, and at-risk behaviors of children in our state. Folks in this room probably know very well that this is administered every 3 years to 5th, 8th, 9th, and 11th graders. And in 2013, we worked really closely with the Department of Health and Department of Ed to add an item for the first time ever about whether or not youth experienced the incarceration of a parent. And so for the first time in 2013, there was this new question added: have any of your parents or guardians ever been in jail or prison? I want to note before we turn to the data on this that the fifth graders were excluded from this particular item. It was deemed as part of a whole set of items that this one was too sensitive to ask fifth graders. And so what's reflected here in the data are responses from 8th, 9th, and 11th graders about their experiences with parental incarceration. What you can see here is that among youth in public schools, 1 in 6 report a history of parental incarceration. As we look at youth in other settings, including alternative learning centers and youth and juvenile correctional facilities, the number of youth that are impacted by parental incarceration increases in a stepwise fashion, meaning that nearly half, or 43%, of youth in alternative schools have experienced the incarceration of a parent. And those kids in juvenile correctional facilities, again, 1 in 6 have a parent that is currently incarcerated. When we think about this from an intergenerational or two-generational approach, this is staggering. We've already begun incarcerating youth, and we know their parents are incarcerated at the same time. This is really, truly a public health crisis, and one that we know has really critical opportunities for intervention. These data give us a sense of the scope of the problem, and I want to put in context, before we think about youth's outcomes, how we think about parental incarceration as it impacts children and their development. Many of the folks in this room are probably familiar with the idea of ACEs, or adverse childhood experiences, this set of 10 childhood ACEs that are thought to cause considerable adversity and stress for children and have important implications for health and development across the life course. So what's important to note here is that the parental incarceration is one of these ACEs. And what's particularly important is that so often, other ACEs are the root cause of parental incarceration: parent mental health, parent substance abuse, violence in the home. And these are challenges that mean that for kids that are experiencing parental incarceration, they're often experiencing many other ACEs as well. And so it's this constellation of risk factors that we think confers risk for children across their life course. We know that the data bear this out. So these are data from the National Survey of Children's Health. My colleague Kristen Turney published a paper looking at ACEs by parental incarceration status. And what I want to draw your attention to here is that results indicate that children of incarcerated parents are exposed to nearly 5 times as many other ACEs as their counterparts without incarcerated parents. Again, they have 5 times as many ACEs. And so when we think about a group of kids that really demands our attention, this is, in fact, that group. They are experiencing considerable adversity relative to their peers that don't have an incarcerated parent. Nearly 86% of children who experience parental incarceration in this sample experienced 1 or more other ACEs. And of course, this is important because we know that ACEs and the constellation of these ACEs and the cumulative risks has long-term implications for health and development. We know that the more ACEs you have is correlated with increased risk for smoking, substance abuse, and other physical health conditions like diabetes, cancer, and stroke, right? So we start to see this pileup of adversity that's happening in childhood and carries through into adult well-being. So next I want to turn to what do we know about kids in Minnesota who have experienced the incarceration of a parent. And I'm going to breeze through this very quickly. Nothing like having a couple slides to represent 5 peer-reviewed publications, which I will do the very best I can to not both bore you or depress you, because frankly, as we get to the end, the picture is pretty bleak. So we have used data from the Minnesota Student Survey to look at a host of outcomes among youth in Minnesota. We've looked at outcomes related to school, mental health, substance use, externalizing behaviors like physical fighting and aggression, and physical health behaviors. And I'm going to walk through briefly the summary of findings for each of these studies that we've conducted. First, we've looked at school outcomes. Looks like this is no longer advancing for me. I may need some technical assistance, which is not something I often say.
Carl, you got help there?
So this was never moving, but
yes.
That is.
And this is not moving anymore. Okay. I don't know what to do, so let me go find it there.
I'm going to keep moving. So if we were advancing these slides here, we'd be looking at this first box up at the top, thinking about academic outcomes. What we know is among youth with currently and formerly incarcerated parents, they have higher rates of unexcused absences, lower grades, more discipline, less school connection and less school engagement compared to their peers who have no history of incarceration. We find very similar pattern of results as it relates to mental health outcomes. Youth with incarcerated parents or a history of parental incarceration report more internalizing symptoms. They're substantially more likely than their peers to report purposeful self-injury. They have significantly higher rates of suicide ideation and suicide attempt. They're also more likely than their peers to report using substances of all kinds, and at startlingly high rates. So they report higher rates of alcohol use and more problems from that use, higher rates of tobacco use and vaping of all forms when we look at the most recent data, higher use of all other illegal drugs, and they report across the board higher consequences from this use compared to their peers who don't have a history of parental incarceration. We also just recently published a paper looking at externalizing behavior problems, things like damage to property, physical fighting, theft, bullying, and lying and con behavior. Again, all self-reported behaviors, and we find the same pattern of results again. Kids with currently and formerly incarcerated parents fare worse than their peers on all of these measures, despite including a lot of statistical controls to try to account for some of that other variation in age, gender, race and ethnicity, poverty and urbanicity. These results hold when we think about outcomes for children. And then finally, we've also looked at parental incarceration as it relates to physical health and health behaviors. Things like self-reported overall health, they are more likely to report that they are using, or they exercise less, so they have lower levels of physical activity compared to their peers. They report lower levels of fruit and vegetable consumption, more fast food consumption, and they're getting less sleep compared to their peers. Combined, this creates this constellation of outcomes that we see for a group of youth that clearly demonstrate that this particular experience in childhood confers considerable risk across a whole host of domains for children. In summary, I just want to hit some of the highlights in the absence of these slides advancing where you can see them. What we know is that on any given day in Minnesota, more than 26,000 children are currently impacted by a parent's incarceration. And across every indicator that we've examined, youth with a history of parental incarceration fare worse than their peers. And most of these data indicate that kids who are currently experiencing the incarceration of a parent are faring worse than their peers who experienced this in the past. But I want to emphasize that past experience, that this doesn't mitigate the risk entirely. Kids who experienced this in the past still look worse than their peers who have never had this experience. This provides us with really what I think is a very clear and convincing snapshot of this particular risk for young children and older children and youth as well, thinking about having consequences for future health and development. The last thing I want to leave you with is data that came from a recent systematic review that was just recently published that said that that to treat the health issues that come from parental incarceration, the total annual costs were estimated at $22.5 billion to treat the health of adults and $346 million to treat the health outcomes of children. Those are annual costs when we think about the effects of parental incarceration on adult and child health at a national scale. So last, I think we'll hear a lot of opportunities today for intervention before, during, and after incarceration. And I think what I want this committee to know is that this provides us with, again, a window into all of the challenges. We know that there are lots of kids who are thriving despite having an incarcerated parent. And I'll be very honest in saying that the science is just not there yet. We know a little bit about what helps protect kids, and there are a growing set of policies, both big and little P policies, to think about how do we support children with incarcerated parents. But we know a lot less about what's happening in our state. And frankly, we haven't seen the state take the lead on interventions to really support this population of young people. And I think that we're at a great time to do so. So in the absence of a closing slide, I'll just stop and say I'm happy to take any questions or be a resource for anyone as we continue to discuss this issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Before I go to questions, part of that was a little depressing. 1991, the Blue Earth County Jail received the award for State Program of the Year for their parenting class. Mm-hmm. And so now, 30 years later, we're still struggling to implement that and recognize the benefits of it. Sorry, that did depress me just a little bit. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You had given us the statistics for 2013 from the student survey, and I was just curious. I know that was my freshman term here at the legislature, and a lot has changed here at the legislature since 2013, and I see Commissioner Schnell behind you, and his predecessor and I worked on legislation and policies within the DOC, and he and I have continued that work. So I'm hoping that the answer is that you've seen some change, because we've done quite a few things to try to move that needle. Do you see the student surveys the same as you did in 2013 for the preceding years that you also studied?
That's a great question. And actually, in the 2019 survey, we were able to add a new question about resident status. We have not truthfully done a ton of digging into that. I will tell you that the initial passes at the data that we have run that just recently came out look very similar in terms of patterns. I would say that the overall story is the same. I chose here to focus on the 2013 data because all of these are peer-reviewed studies that have been published, but the overall patterns look the same. I will say, with regard to the state surveys of parents in Minnesota prisons and parents in Minnesota jails, those were one-time studies that I funded at the University of Minnesota. There was no financial support from either the Department of Corrections or the Minnesota Sheriff's Association to do those. So those were really one-time studies. And you're right, they're going to be dated. And so as we think about what we learned 5 years ago or just a few years ago in terms of the number of parents in prisons and jails, if we don't put processes in place to systematically collect that data on an annual basis, I don't know when we will continue to get that information.
Okay. Erica, do you want to take a shot at fixing this while we're doing the questioning? Representative O'Neill, your follow-up question, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. About a year ago, I had attended a conference in my district, and it was hosted by several of the therapist organizations in my district, Central Minnesota Mental Health, and a few other folks. They were kind enough to allow me to come in and kind of audit their whole conference. And one thing that really was impactful when we talked about the ACEs study on that particular day was the trajectory. So you had very clearly laid out what happens when you have a high ACEs score and you have problematic things all over the board. You've got health issues, you have chemical dependency issues, you have criminality issues, and they sort of follow in the footsteps of their parents. But on that particular day, the ACEs study that they talked about was really interesting because it was kind of a dual trajectory. Mm-hmm. So you have that, which we are all well aware of, but you also have the other side, which is the people that are looking for kind of high stress, crisis. They end up as like an ER doctor. They end up as a paramedic. They end up as a firefighter, a law enforcement person, even a corrections officer. So can you just speak to us just a little bit about the other trajectory, and is there any, you had talked about you need more study to find out how do you urge or kind of push someone in that other trajectory to actually be law-abiding and a productive citizen and actually an example of kind of overcoming problematic things in their childhood?
Yeah, that's a great question, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I think that there are lots of studies that look at protective factors and things that promote resilience among children who have a host of ACEs, right? So when I spoke earlier about not having data here, it was really specific to parental incarceration and in Minnesota in terms of needing more about what protects this group of kids. I think that we know that there are a handful of protective factors. Some of them are intelligence, having a strong attachment to a parent or a parental figure, being connected to school. These are things that we know help promote resilience in kids who have experienced adversity. And so I think we will find that some of the same protective factors help mitigate the risk for kids with incarcerated parents. In the little bit of work that we've done with Minnesota data, we show that things like strong parent-child connectedness do help, but they don't buffer all of the risk. And so it is, I think, important to think about coordinated and consolidated effort, because it just can't be the schools being responsible for promoting resilience. It has to be supports for parents, whether that's access to mental health care for the parents, substance abuse treatment for the parents, promoting opportunities for kids to learn in safe places, to have extracurricular activities, again, in safe neighborhoods. It is all of the things we can think about to support youth that are going to help put them on a positive path.
Just a follow-up statement. Okay.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a conversation with the same type of people, the therapy folks, and I had actually served on the board up in St. Cloud for Central Minnesota Mental Health. And it was interesting, around this kind of roundtable conversation, they were talking about it takes five adults to really speak into a child's life and be a permanent feature and an ongoing feature in their life for them to kind of have healthy, happy outcomes. Are you seeing that in your studies too, as you're looking at things?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think whether it's five or six or three for some is really hard to say, right? I think what we know is that young people thrive when they are supported by adults in their communities, in their homes, in their schools. And that is very clear. It's really particularly hard for this group of kids when we think about how incarceration often sets off collateral consequences. Kids end up moving homes, moving caregivers, moving schools. So they may have been connected to a school or a teacher or a school social worker. And then when their parent becomes incarcerated, the bottom falls out. And right, they need to go live with auntie or grandma. Their schools have shifted, their basketball coach changes, all of these things set off really a domino effect, and it makes it harder for those folks who are connected to that youth to stay engaged. So I think all of the things that we can do to continue to support students and youth when the bottom falls out, when their parent becomes incarcerated, can continue to promote those really healthy parent-child, adult-child relationships that we know promote resilience.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Pinto, Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder if this may be a slightly more positive angle on this, which is that I know that our state has kind of made a strategic decision to have relatively greater proportion of our population that is greater portions under community corrections and a relatively smaller proportion that is incarcerated. And that's a decision that we've had for a number of decades now. And I wonder if you're aware of a comparison in our state versus others in that because of that choice to have more living in the community, that's buffered a little bit of the effect of this at all. If you just comment on that.
Mr. Chairs and members of the committee, it's a great question. I think for as little as we know about children with incarcerated parents in the grand scheme of things, we know almost nothing about children with parents on community supervision. And that's a place that the science really needs to catch up. We know, though, that community supervision does not come without stress for the family system, right? There are a number of restrictions that are put on people who have community supervision or probation in terms of just the stress of needing to countlessly drop UAs, the risk or the threat of going to jail or prison if they screw up, sometimes limitations and when neighborhoods they can go to, which could be their kid's school, right? So we know that there are anecdotally considerable stressors for parents who are on community supervision. But whether or not that's an alternative to incarceration and what that means for kids' outcomes, I think the science is not there yet. It's a great question, though.
Thank you. Anybody else? Once, twice. Thank you so much for your testimony. Up next, we have Ms. Tanya Hennessy. Am I getting close there?
You got it.
Yep. Okay. Thank you. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Yeah. So my name is Tanya Hunsey. I'm an incarceration survivor. I'm also a revolutionary mother of three boys and the founder of an organization called We Rise. It's a leadership collective of formerly incarcerated women doing policy and systems change in a transformative, restorative, and healing justice lens. I want to thank you for taking the time to listen to my story today and also call to the fact that this is my story, but it's not unique. This is happening all over, has been for decades. I'm just have the privilege of being able to sit in front of you today, but there are many mothers and fathers and children of incarceration whose story we don't get to hear. And so I just want to be able to call that today. I spent over 25 years of my life under either incarceration or community sentencing or court supervision. 20 years of that, I was a mother. I became a mother at 16, and I became incarcerated at the first time as a 12-year-old. Throughout my lifetime, it was drugs was my issue, and I used drugs to deal with my trauma because I didn't have any other way to deal with my trauma, and it continued on. At 16, when I became a mother, I remember thinking, I'm never going to let my demons affect my child. Never will I let that happen to him. And I failed miserably at that because I continued to become incarcerated. I continued to use drugs. I continued to sell drugs because I had no other way of working through my issues, working through the trauma that I grew up with. And once you become incarcerated and you get out and you're a mother, you have a certain amount of time to get your child back. And to have that, you have to have stable and secure housing. You have to have employment. You have to have all of these things that you have no way to get. So we continue to go back into situations where they're either unsafe, or you go back to selling drugs, or you go back to criminal activity because that's the way that you know how to get money, or you go back to a abusive relationship because you need to have a house to have your babies. And that cycle continues, and it continues, and it continues. We know in Minnesota there's 37,000 women coming out of incarceration every year, and that's from the Prison Policy Institute study that they put out last year. So there's 37,000 women coming out of incarceration, most of whom are mothers. You know, one of the myths that we have with an incarcerated parent is that either we don't want to be mothers, we didn't want our children, that we don't want to be a part of their lives, that it doesn't affect us. And I can tell you that every day that I was incarcerated, I had to not only disassociate from the pain of being away from my children, but I had to, otherwise I wouldn't be able to survive while we're incarcerated, because incarceration is family separation. That's what it is. And it's not only painful for us, but it's painful for our families, our children, our communities. It continues to rip our communities apart. I wanted nothing more than to be a mother and to be a good mother. But the truth is when we get out of incarceration, there's not support for mothers to become reunified with our kids and to be able to get a leg up, to be able to be successful in the community. And when you're dealing with a drug addiction, it's not because you want to choose to be a criminal, right? Like, I don't ever remember being given a choice of having a safe and stable house with loving parents, a good school, all the opportunities, or go out and sell drugs. Nobody would choose that. Nobody would. What we're talking about here is survival, right? We don't know any other way to survive. So we continue to use drugs, or we continue to live that life because we don't know any other way to survive out in the community. If we had the opportunities and the support in the community, the last thing we'd want to do is to hurt our children. You know, I look at my children now, who I have a 25-year-old, a 19-year-old, and a fiery, redheaded 5-year-old who's changed my life completely. He's taught me who's the boss and who's not the boss. But I look at my older boys, and still every day, they're still dealing with the trauma of not having me there. And I asked them, what would you, they just wanted to be with their mom. They just wanted a real family. They just wanted me there. And I can never do anything to take that away from them, but I do every day work so other children do not have to feel that same pain. If we have opportunities in the community to stay in the community, we're not going to deal with family separation. When we look at the daily report of how many women are incarcerated right now in Shakopee, over 50% are for drugs alone. And I don't want to take away from the fact that 90% of the women that are incarcerated in the United States for murder, it's against their abuser. So we don't like to even separate violent and nonviolent. It's really hard to do when we are criminalizing survival, right? And so those children also want to be with their mom. They want to have a happy, healthy, safe, and stable place to be. And if we could take the resources that we're using to continue to push families apart by incarceration, and put those into building a stronger family and community, we would change the dynamic, right? Those kids would be able to be healthy and whole. They wouldn't have to worry about being going to different schools. They wouldn't have to worry about being separated from their parents. I think that we have a big opportunity to be able to make some real change in Minnesota. And when we talk about, you know, the fact that we do have a lower incarceration rate, but the fact is 37,000 women are coming out of incarceration every year. And we can do better. You know, my 19-year-old spoke on a panel one time for families of incarcerated parents. And we were talking, and he goes to a school that has a lot of kids that have incarcerated parents or incarceration has touched their lives. And I asked him a question because I was moderating the panel. How many other kids do you know of that have a parent that's incarcerated? And he said, none. And I sat back and I was like, what is going on here? Because we know that, you know, working with all of the case managers and the student supports there that they do. But when we're talking about this, think of the shame that these children have. They don't talk about their parent being incarcerated because it's widely known that only bad people go to prison. Only bad people go to jail. So they're not seeing their parent as bad, so they don't want to talk about that because they don't want other people to think the parent is a bad person. How we support those kids, how we support them in the schools when they can't even be open and honest about the fact that their parents are incarcerated because it's so much shame goes with that. You know, I can talk about my story. I was actually in jail with my grandfather. So when we talk about intergenerational trauma of incarceration, it continues on. You know, I don't want to take up any more of your time. I just want to be able to say thank you again for allowing me to speak and tell my story. And again, it's not unique. There's so many women and so many fathers that want to be fathers. And when we are released from incarceration, the trauma that happens in trying to reconnect with our children. My 5-year-old has never had me incarcerated. Barely has me going to the bathroom by myself, to be honest with you. But I still have to remind myself, it's okay. It's okay. Go over and connect with him. Put your arms around him. Because there's something that we don't talk about that's reentry trauma and the fear of going back. Even though I've changed my life completely, even though there's incarceration is so far behind me, it's still carried with me every day. And I'm still afraid that I'm going to do something and I'm going to lose my children again, that I'm going to end up back in prison. It's not a real, you know, I'm able to talk myself down from that, but it's still, we see those things every day with trying to connect with my 5-year-old, with trying to connect with my older children, trying to connect with my parents, my mom, my dad, and saying it's okay. It's okay to start to heal those bonds because you're not going anywhere. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. I personally find it really helpful when we're talking to somebody that's actually lived it. In my experience at the Blue Earth County Jail, I think I was there 2 years when I had seen 3 generations of one family, and at another point had mother, father, and son all there that came in separately, and they had a reunion because they hadn't seen each other. We've got to break that cycle. Are there questions from the members? Ms. Christensen, Representative Christensen.
Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about the reentry trauma. That's an interesting. Do you have ideas, solutions, of what kinds of things could happen that would help to sort of ease that transition?
Not incarcerating the parent to begin with, right? If we can keep them in the community, they don't, and start to build a stronger community where we can reimagine community instead of reimagining prisons, where we're saying we're going to keep you in your community and start to help you connect with the resources that you need. If that's safe and stable housing, if that's mental health, if that's chemical dependency treatments, if those are the things that you need. But what we really need is our people to connect with us, jobs, housing, being able to understand how to parent, right? Like, I didn't understand that it was okay to be annoyed with your children until I, this, you know, like, oh my goodness, that doesn't make me a bad parent, but really starting to come around and just supporting. Because you, that, how do you end recidivism? You don't incarcerate to begin with.
Representative Christensen, follow up? Okay, thank you. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much for coming to see me with Gina Evans in my office just this last week. And it was fun how we reconnected, and I won't tell the Hope Committee what that was because that's your story to tell. But I do appreciate you sharing that with me. That was an amazing full circle.
Yeah.
So in light of what our conversation, I want to bring up the alternatives to incarceration and give a little plug for that. And the reason I'm saying that, too, is because so Gina Evans and I in particular and Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge worked on the Alternatives to Incarceration program that finally did get launched, and it was it's up in Anoka County. And they found that, as we talked about in my office, that this is, instead of incarcerating somebody that has a nonviolent drug offense, sending them instead when they've had multiple technical violations and they're headed right back to prison because of that, offering them an inpatient drug and alcohol treatment. And, of course, my hope is that it would go beyond where it is right now in the pilot program. But I think that, that there's hope. We talked about hope in my office, and I see a great amount of hope. And I'm saying this, too, because you have Commissioner Schnell sitting behind you, and we all have been working collaboratively to try to expand this idea of alternatives to incarceration, to keep people connected, but to, more importantly, which is part of your story and Gina's story, too, to find the treatment and the healing and the hope that you were missing before. So I'm just going to, if you want to, you know, say anything about that, but I think it's so important that we go beyond the pilot program in Anoka County, which did see a 62% reduction in recidivism for people that were absolutely 100% said going to go back to prison. And again, it kept people together and in their communities too. So that was just a little plug there to keep working on funding that statewide and be more inclusive of more than just Anoka County or the counties themselves doing it, but also partnering with places like RS Eden, who also helped with this, and with Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge, and other places that have shown high success that are out privately, you know, in the private sector and nonprofit sector. Yeah. So I don't know if you want to address that at all and what your thoughts are about that program and that's kind of where it was birthed from, was RS Eden and Minnesota Adult Teen Challenge.
Yeah, thank you so much for bringing that up. We also have a bill that we're introducing, and it's called the Primary Caregiver Bill, that would make a way for those programs and community sentencing for all primary caregivers of a minor child. But I went through treatment 13 times. Right. I went through treatment 13 times before I was able to, and like I said, incarcerated over and over and over and over again. But what I really needed was to be a part of that community and have real support around me. And when I did go through the last time, it was life changing. Because what we need is healing. Right. Like, that's the core. We're not finding that in prison. That's only adding more to our trauma. That's not a place to be able to put down your walls and start to work on childhood traumas or sexual abuse or physical abuse trauma, because you are in a state of survival in there. And if we can get people to stay in the communities like the Alternatives to Incarceration pilot and make that everywhere, where people are able to stay in their communities and able to start to find people that really do care and to understand. You know, I was in your office, I was telling you how when I started realizing that there was people that really did care and really seen me as something more than just what I have done, more than just a drug addict and a junkie, as someone who needed support and to be able to get that healing and believed in me. And that's really what I needed, and to believe in my children and believe that me being a mother was something that was sacred and should have been held up and supported.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment, too. And I want to point out, too, that level of care that you needed was found in the nonprofit sector and in the private sector. So I think it's really important that we incorporate that and not just add on more programming for the sake of programming, but actually those that have shown a great success, which is why that's, you know, I partnered with successful nonprofit organizations. And so I just want to point that out too.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you for sharing.
Thank you. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just really want to thank you too for speaking with us. I serve as a prosecutor outside the legislature and have I'm pretty much every day involved in cases where people are confined, whether in jail or in prison, and to have to hear from people who've had that experience and to share that with us is just critical. And I really want to both lift that up and then also the work that you're doing with other people who have experienced incarceration. It's just so important we recognize the humanity in everybody involved. And I guess especially what you're making me think is the strong connection between corrections policy, which you've been talking about, and early childhood policy, as incarcerated individuals are our parents. And I guess I'm really was jumping out at me as the slide from Dr. Schlafer showing that more than half of those of young people in correctional facilities have had parents incarcerated. And I cannot think of a better example of that cycle that you're referring to. So thank you so much for your work and for sharing your story.
Thank you.
Anybody else have a question? Thank you so much for your testimony. At this point, I will pass the gavel over to Chair Pinto. And he'll take it from here.
Thank you, Chair Considine. And thank you so much to our first again, to our first two testifiers, and we'll have the group from the Incarcerated Parents Work Group come and get yourselves settled in. And I know we're getting the presentation adjusted. As we are, I'll just say how pleased I am to have this hearing come together on this really important topic. I don't know that folks would necessarily have thought about the intersection between the Corrections Committee and the Early Childhood Committee, but in fact, there's a significant connection, as I hope has already been clear in the first portion of the presentation.
As they continue to set up, we'll throw in another little commercial.
Mr. Chair.
I'd like us also to start thinking about diversion prior to arrest. The Before the Yellow Line project that has been, again, tried in Blue Earth County, where they have a social worker sitting there and on things that are pretty clear cut, like substance abuse, mental health issues. They are diverting people before they're booked into the jail. The earlier the intervention, the better. I think that's something we really agree on. So are you ready to go?
We are. Thank you for getting our slides up and going. You have three of us presenting today, and I'll launch this conversation.
And so if you can please identify yourself for the record, and then please proceed.
My name is Sheila Kiskaden. I'm an Olmsted County Commissioner, and I am a member of the State Community Health Services Advisory Council, which is a local state council that works together on public health policy through the Minnesota Department of Health.
And Commissioner, a former legislator as well.
I am. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I had the pleasure of serving in the Senate for 14 years. And when I left the Senate, I got very involved with early childhood issues, which I had not been while I was a legislator. And then I got talked into running for the Olmsted County Board. So after being out of office for 8 years, 7 years ago, I ran for the Olmsted County Board, which was coming home because I'd been a staffer at Olmsted County many years before and worked in corrections, as a matter of fact, among other things. And one of the first things that I asked to do when I became a county commissioner was to see the jail, because we had a jail that had been built since I had been there, thank you. And like many people, I was kind of astonished when I went through our jail to see who was in jail compared to who had been in jail when I worked there in the 80s. And I was struck by the number of brown faces in our jail compared to years past, and began to think about the issue of the early childhood impact of having an incarcerated parent, because I'd done a lot of work in that arena. So then I discovered Rebecca Schaffler's research, which was really striking, the work that she had already done. I became part of a little work group that public safety had put together looking at the strengthening families affected by incarceration. And I became really clear to me that the counties were in a great place to do something, that we were uniquely positioned because we do run county jails and we do have public health and we do run social services and we are the front door to the state of Minnesota for all kinds of services. So a task force was formed through the Association of Minnesota Counties, and that study that Rebecca Schaffler reported to you was one of the things that we encouraged her to do and supported getting done. And through that task force, we met for 2 or 3 years, and suddenly we realized that the real answer for how we should proceed was partnering with the Sheriff's Association and with the State Community Health Services Advisory Council. And the thinking there was simply this, that a parental what is the role of counties with the children of incarcerated parents? That was our study question. And with the support of the State Sheriff's Association and with the State Community Health Services Advisory Council, we've studied that question for 2 years. We had a work group that represented not only local government, county commissioners and corrections and public health and social services, jail administrators, and we just kept asking ourselves that question over and over again. And just as you heard from a person with lived experience, we invited in caregivers of children of incarcerated parents. We invited in formerly incarcerated parents, and we invited in children, youths who had experienced parental incarceration. And I would really say that a lot of our findings really were drawn heavily from the conversations that we had with those people with the lived experience. Because parental incarceration, as you've already heard, is an adverse childhood experience, and as you've already heard, it is the most commonly reported one on our Minnesota State student survey. So I'm going to turn it over now to Bill Hutton, Executive Director of the Sheriff's Association, and we're going to just kind of share this presentation.
All right, Sheriff Hutton.
Good afternoon. My name is Bill Hutton. I am the Executive Director of Minnesota Sheriff's Association. I'm also a retired Washington County Sheriff for 3 terms. Many of the things that Dr. Schleffler talked a little bit about, some of that information she received from the Washington County Sheriff's Office because we were one of her study groups. And Dr. Schleffler and I spent a lot of time together. And I should say thank you for taking the time to hear this. And please keep in mind that when we have or when the three of us up here are talking, this is county-centric. We are not talking about the state system. We are talking about counties and how we counties interact with parents of incarcerated children of incarcerated parents. I took over as sheriff in 2007. I was a city police officer for 23 years. And when you take over a new role, as many of you know, you spend a lot of time at the office. So at night when I'd leave the office, get there at 6 o'clock in the morning, I would leave at, 8 o'clock at night, and I'd walk out in the lobby area of the sheriff's office, and again, it's Washington County, a larger county, and I thought we were running a daycare. We had children running all over the lobby of the sheriff's office. So Representative Christensen, if you've been up there, you realize there's that little split in that large area in there, and that's where the kids were running around. And quite frankly, I said to myself, what the hell's going on here? Why do we have all these kids running around the sheriff's office? And then I had an individual tell me, obviously, that they're here to visit their parents whom are incarcerated. And then the next thing I thought to myself, well, why would they bring their kids here to a jail to visit their parents? This is my ignorance talking, right? This is what I was learning. I was pretty good at, as an investigator in a law enforcement agency, in getting bringing individuals into the county jail, not understanding the complexities of a jail. And I will tell you that a jail is probably the most complex area of a sheriff's office. And so then I thought, well, this can't happen. We got to be doing something here. And then along came Dr. Schleffler and the University of Minnesota and studies that she was completing, and they spent 2.5 years, Dr. Schleffler, at the Washington County Sheriff's Office, among other places, and then not at the conclusion, but as she was further into her studies, she gave us a report. And from that moment in time, I was hooked. What can we do? What could I do? At that point, I was a sheriff. What could I do as a sheriff to change this, to turn this around? What can we do differently? Because what we are doing is not working. So I'm going to fast forward that now. Now I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, and the question is, what can we do? What can I do as the executive director for the 87 sheriffs, 79 of which have county jails? What can we do to intervene? What can we do to make a difference? And that's why we have such a great relationship with Dr. Scheffler and her group, and also the group that we have from here. So it's made a huge impact on individuals within Washington County, at least individuals who are in our jail, and the relationships that we built with community corrections, community health, and everybody else in between.
So one of the things that we consistently learned is that people were, this is the population that is not visible at the county level. We don't, you know, the sheriff doesn't have to think about them. The public health people don't have to think about the children of incarcerated parents. The corrections officers are busy. You know, no one's thinking about the children. And yet when, just from that first time when I toured our county jail and I met with our jail program administrator and our child protection supervisor and said, what are we doing about the children of incarcerated parents? And they looked at me blankly. And then the sheriff, the jail program administrator said, you know, I've been a program administrator here for 27 years. Right now I have an 18-year-old in jail. I had his father. I had his grandfather. He has a 2-year-old. So I guess in 16 years. Over and over again, we have found that children of incarcerated parents are generally not supported or identified by the service systems. They are invisible, and yet you sort of call it out, just as Dr. Scheffler has done, and it's like, I should have thought of that. How come we're not thinking about this as a population where we know we can promote resiliency, where we can make a difference? And we, as you've heard already, the children are traumatized, and they need emotional support. They need a relationship and a contact with their parent or their caregiver, and it's across the state. My own county is one. All visiting is video. That is not really, does not really promote very much parental contact or bonding, yet it's better than nothing. In some places of the state, if you live in far northern Minnesota, it makes it possible for you to have a visit with someone who's incarcerated because of the distance. So distance becomes an issue. But they crave physical contact with their children, and they need a relationship with their parent and giver. They're still parents. Visiting a parent in jail is confusing, and it's stressful. I don't know if you've toured a county jail. I invite you to do that. You will find it stressful just going in as a visitor. But if you're a young child or a parent bringing your children to visit with your incarcerated family member, it is very stressful. And sometimes the policies don't consider the needs of children. And one of the things we heard about that's like, oh, aha, you have like a 20-minute visit, but if that 3-year-old has to go to the bathroom, well, your visit's over. So, you know, there are little things that can be done that really just humanize the whole process, and there's a willingness to do it once it's kind of pointed out. And so the parents also see, as you just heard from Tanya, the parents see their role as critical too. They want to be engaged with their children. They want to be a good parent. They may need a lot of help getting there, but they haven't stopped being a parent because they're incarcerated, and they haven't stopped loving their children because they're incarcerated, nor have the children started loving them. And then, as you already heard, children feel stigmatized, and they feel that they suffer in silence and they suffer in isolation. There's a town of Stuartville south of Rochester, and the school counselor told our sheriff, never stop publishing on your website who's in the county jail. And the sheriff said, well, why is that important to you? He said, well, because if we have a child who's misbehaving or not showing up for school, it's one of the places we check. What's happened to this child? That whole question of trauma, what happened to you? You know, what's happened in this child's family? It's a clue. It gives them a starting place to work with the child. And we are increasingly, as we began doing this work, Dawn and I wrote up from Rochester together this morning, and we are having people on our staff asking if they can come work on this project that we've got launched about the children of incarcerated parents, because they are successful adults with degrees working in corrections or working in county government who are the children of incarcerated parents and who know that stigma, but also know some things about resiliency. And so that's important. So, Bill, are you doing key conclusions or am I?
You can.
All right. Bill and I talk more than Bill.
Yes, she does.
Yes, I do. So here's what we learned overall. Counties have a very unique opportunity to break the cycle and change outcomes. We are the front line. Attention to children really should start really even pre-arrest, but certainly at the point of arrest, through pre-trial, incarceration, and in community reentry. There are protocols in some parts of the country where you look, you know, I've heard of terrible stories of a parent being arrested while the child was at school. No one provides for the child comes home. And there have been situations where children have tried to make it on their own for quite some time. But how do we make it less traumatizing for a child? Can we arrest the parent when the child isn't there, but make sure that there's things for the child, but that it goes on through the whole phase at the county, you know, as counties are engaged with arrest and pretrial and sentencing and reentry. We can provide supports and service that build resilience for these children and for their families. And we have the capacity to do that within our not-for-profit sector and sometimes with our own staff as well. And we do need to partner and have a community response to support the resilience of these children. So we see the county sheriff, the public health, social services, child protection, corrections, community organizations. We think they all have a role.
I can talk a little bit about this. Sure. Awareness, levels of awareness or levels of change. This spans the globe with the 87 sheriffs in Minnesota. You can begin to talk about this topic with some of the sheriffs, and it's like a high-pitched sound for a dog. The head just kind of turns. But there are other sheriffs that are really well into this. We have Carlton County, for example, that has a great relationship with their public health people, their community services, their corrections, their schools, their nonprofits in their communities. They are very well engaged in this topic. Our role, our responsibility is to change, is to provide awareness to individuals, to provide awareness to our sheriffs so they can understand what's going on, the difference that can be made. Also, changing attitude, right? Again, self-admit, in 2006, I was elected as the county sheriff, and I was elected because I was pretty good at putting people in jail. I needed to change my attitude. I needed to understand everything that was going on around it. And then, as I've already described to you, it was like a call to action for me as a sheriff. How could I change the things? And what could I change within my organization? What relationships could I build within my county to make sure that I was making a difference? Likewise, it's a call to action that we have to our sheriffs across the state to, again, show them what is happening, the best practices that are going on out there, and the differences that they can make.
At the same time, there's a call to action of public health. And almost all of our communities, public health is very involved in maternal and child health. Public health is very involved in mental health issues for children and with families, and having that kind of partner. That's why the State Community Health Advisory Council has agreed to do phase two. We generally do a study for a year or so, and then things are move on. And we've agreed to do a phase two. Again, phase two, sponsored by the State Community Health Advisory Council and by the Sheriff's Association. It will be co-chaired. I'm stepping out of that co-chair role, and Dawn Beck from Olmsted County will step into the co-chair role along with Bill Hutton. And we will be looking to move forward with that strategy of how do we build awareness, how do we change attitudes, and then how does that lead to action, knowing that the action will have to happen pretty much at the county level based on their capacity, their resources, but on the basis of their knowledge. With the work that Dr. Schaffler has done and others, we are actually kind of interestingly positioned as a state. There's a growing awareness of this need across the country. There isn't a lot of thoughtful statewide efforts underway. There are pockets of innovation all around the country. We are kind of well positioned as the state of Minnesota to take a lead role in learning what does work, what is the capacity at the local level. Just some of the questions that were raised earlier about what really would be the effective way to go forward. So I'm going to turn it over to Dawn, and she's going to tell you what we're planning to do in actions and strategies for phase two.
Ms. Beck, please introduce yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Dawn Beck. I'm an associate director with Olmsted County. I actually started out on the State Community Health Services Advisory Committee's chair work group on children of incarcerated parents on the invitation of Commissioner Kiskaden. As I knew when this work group was starting, I am the child of an incarcerated parent, and so I had shared my story with her and said, if there's anything I can do, please let me know, because I'd like to advocate for the children. A few months later, she asked if I could be on the committee, and so I've been on the committee for about 18 months. I am a public health professional, have currently changed jobs working for county administration with the sheer role of trying to advance how Olmsted County and Minnesota can better support children of incarcerated parents. So I'll be co-chairing phase two of the work group with Mr. Hutton. And our strategies will revolve around, first, how are we going to build the change strategy through information and awareness sessions, and specifically supporting a learning community of some counties that have come together to implement the National Institute of Corrections best practices around family-friendly practices in jails and prisons. So some specific details.
Ms. Beck, can I just pause you for a second?
Sure.
Chair Constantine, I know, is going to need to leave shortly, and he had a quick question, I think, for the commissioner.
Sure.
Chair Constantine.
Thank you, Chair. You mentioned that the school district in Stuartville had said, please don't quit publishing the thing. It's a tool for us to help, which sounds really great, but flip side of that is it's then easier to identify for other people whose parents are in there. Do you have any comments on how that balances out, or which it just seemed like it's a real two-edged sword?
Commissioner.
Well, Representative, I really don't think I'm qualified to answer that because I haven't given that much thought. I think it, I guess I was just struck with the fact that it's a tool that counselors can use. I guess there would be a flip side, but in smaller communities, you generally know who are the troublemakers and who are not, not always. But that's worth some consideration, and I don't really have a response that I feel would add to the discussion today.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much for your response. You're actually, when you said that, it was the first time I ever thought of any positive reason for doing it, because frankly, there are a lot of people that just sort of check it so they can, you know, find something negative.
Right. Well, I will say that there are some, there's at least one county in northern Minnesota that I won't name the county because I never can remember, but they are, they're doing something that they call, handle with care. So they will notify a school district if they need to handle a child with care for whatever reason.
I like that.
And so I think there are ways that can be done that just says to the schools from law enforcement or from child protection or from a physician to handle this child with care today. I think that kind of that seems very sensitive and appropriate to me. So,
okay,
really like that idea. Yeah, thank you.
Good. And so we'll have Ms. Beck finish. We'll have you all finish up, and then we'll of course move to other questions. So Ms. Beck, sorry to interrupt you, and please carry on.
So some of the specifics about the change strategy for phase two really are involved around engaging those with lived experience. So trying to get more formerly incarcerated parents, children of incarcerated parents, and then caregivers involved in the conversation and the decision making about moving forward with this work. Of course, we want to have representation from multiple disciplines and focus at the local level. As my colleagues have said, that's where a lot of the work happens. Supporting that learning community around developing model practices for family friendliness. And then around that, we also want to encourage data collection and research so that we can continue to add to the body of knowledge of what's effective. Around information and awareness, we're going to continue that in partnership with the Minnesota Sheriff's Association and the local public health association. We are planning at this point 3 regional half-day workshops to specifically talk about the topic of children of incarcerated parents. And that really is just kind of a starting point for communities to start having these conversations at the local level to say what's happening in our community and what can we do to help these families. Also promoting awareness through professional conferences, encouraging and supporting research and evaluation along the way, and then working with local champions. As we have mentioned and heard from many of the people testifying, awareness tends to lead to action. Even in my own community, once people learn what I'm doing and they know that Commissioner Cascaden's involved, we've had many people reach out to us and say, we want to be part of the solution. How can we help? And then again, looking at county practices to improve things by using a continuous improvement approach, documenting the lessons learned, and then sharing best practices.
So we're just, we know that you're beginning this study as well, and if there are some issues that our work group could undertake to help inform your policy making, we would be very interested in knowing how we can inform or assist the committee or your communities. And now we'll just sort of stand for questions.
Thank you so much, Commissioner, Ms. Beck, and Sheriff. Questions, members? Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I'm interested in knowing, if you can give me some perspective, is kind of the overlap between incarcerated parents and then foster care. And I know, again, these are, I think you as county, at the county level, have responsibility for both of those systems. Mm-hmm. So the, you know, how that interface works too.
Commissioner.
It's another area that would probably be ripe for deeper discussion, but clearly if a child's, most of the time children have one parent who remains at home, but that isn't always the case. In fact, and oftentimes grandparents end up in that kinship role. We had a member of our team who was a grandparent raising three grandchildren, but both of their parents are incarcerated. Personally know of someone else in my own community and kind of in a similar situation. So I think with foster care, generally you try to keep the children with their parent as long as the parent is able to care for them, or put them into a kinship situation. In my own county, and we are not having huge growth in out-of-home placements because we're doing more stuff on the front end. But I will tell you from the conversations I have with colleagues around the state, out-of-home placements of children, particularly because of the opioid crisis, is a huge cost center and a deep, deep concern at the county level of how are we going to manage the opioid crisis and the consequences to children. And I don't know, perhaps if the sheriff or someone else wants to comment, but there is clearly a connection, and so the earlier conversation about looking at the impact of some states have a family impact assessment that's done as part of a pre-sentence investigation, so that you look at that question and you maybe make a decision about the consequence to the parent in lieu of what might happen with the child. There are a variety of approaches that can be taken, but there is definitely a nexus.
Representative Pryor, is it you? All done? Okay. And any members who may have a response to the questions that the commissioner or the others have framed to us in terms of issues and concerns to address. I guess I'll just note, as folks may be thinking about that it just seems to me that there's a great service you've performed in just shining a light on this. I mean, to have the jail say in response to the commissioner, you know, hadn't really thought about this before. And I suspect that as you develop, whether it's pilot programs, ideas, whatever, that then we really would want to be spread around the state. Of course, that's where I think there can be a real partnership with the state. But it does seem to me that counties are probably very well positioned, because not only are they operating jails, but they're also operating social services, which are then impacted by our failure to take this into account in the first place. So, Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, folks. I have a logistics question. So, and I realize we're not there with all the solutions yet, but I'm just logistically. So if we have someone in the Washington County jail that committed a crime in Washington County, ends up in that jail, and his or her children are in a different county, I mean, is there any kind of reciprocity? I know you're working with all of the sheriffs around the state, but I'm wondering if when we consider programming things like that, if there will be any kind of reciprocity, because it seems that you know, I know the people in our jail in Washington County aren't necessarily residents of Washington County.
Sheriff Hutton.
Mr. Chair, representatives, great question. You are correct. About 51% of the residents within a Washington County jail are not Washington County residents. They're from other counties, being a border county with Wisconsin and all. So it's Wisconsin and Hennepin, Ramsey kind of things. So when we talk about awareness, attitudes, and action, that's exactly what we're trying to do. We're trying to get awareness. It starts at the street level. If an individual is arrested on the street and they're going to be incarcerated or brought to the Washington County Jail, the question has to be asked, which it is not always asked. Are there kids involved? Are there kids at home that are expecting you to come home? Those questions are not always asked. And then if that falls through, then it should be at intake. And then if the individual's through intake and the question's not asked, and you can see in the questionnaire that it's not asked, it has to be asked at the next level. So we can get the other services involved, either through reentry services or, as the commissioner spoke of, if an individual is arrested during the day, we got to make sure that there's a parent or responsible party at home when that child gets home from school. So I hope that answers it. So that's what we're trying to do. That's one of our, as simple as it may sound, and I think the commissioner already talked about some of these things are very simple. Just something very simple like that is going to make a huge difference.
I would put in another thing is looking at our visiting policies, because our visiting policies don't always take into account the travel that families have to make to be able to do the visits. And so extending the times or having flexible times or doing some other kinds of things that make it possible.
Kids first.
Children first, right.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Representative. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very grateful, especially to have Mr. Hutton here today from the Sheriff's Association. Something that we've been talking about quite a bit across the state is as we talk about kind of reforming how we do corrections and where it happens and how it happens. My concern is that the counties aren't overly burdened, for example. So if someone is sentenced to a shorter sentence or a sentence to a year or less, which would be county jail, that would be an additional cost. Or if the DOC, if they do a technical violation and they spend time at the at the jail instead of prison, then the DOC pays for a per diem, but I've heard that that's maybe not enough for some jails across the state. You also have social services, the need is increased, and I know at least in Wright County, they're kind of at the breaking point. You know, social services in Wright County is overwhelmed. So can you just speak a little bit, because you have perspective across the state and across the counties and across the sheriff's jurisdictions, as we start to think about some of these changes, the costs that will be incurred by the counties, that maybe it's a shift from the state to the county. Just can you talk about some of the concerns that are out there, some of those additional costs?
Sheriff Hutton.
Mr. Chair, representatives, you are correct. It could be a concern that there's going to be a shift in services that are being provided, albeit on the flip side of that, I will say those services are well needed. But I will also tell you that there are so many things that can happen at the county jail level that will make such a huge difference that costs next to nothing. That's even just changing our policies. We're talking about visitation policies. This is going to sound very elementary to y'all, but what we did in Washington County, we partnered with Dr. Scheffler, but we also partnered with Sesame Street. And so we had Sesame Street involved with this, and so we had, they're referred to as fatheads, right? So we made our visiting area kid-friendly. And in order for the children to connect with their parents, the inmates were also, offenders were also aware of what we were doing. We brought in kid books. So the books are not only on the visiting side, but they're also on the side when they would visit with the parents. So if a child was reading a book, and again, I know, Representative, I'm not hitting on all your cylinders here, but I'm telling you many of the things that we did just at the county level and the visitation level made a huge difference. We made kids first. kids would come in first. So if the corrections officer would see that there was a family coming in, they moved immediately to the front of the line. Because you can imagine, we only have so many spots for visitations. We only have so much time for visitation. But we also recognize, the staff recognized, which was huge to me, when we had the big meeting with Dr. Schreffler, I did not appreciate how much or how well that the staff was going to embrace this. And so when we had our staff change the culture, if you will, within the staff, they saw it and they embraced all these things. So yes, I do appreciate it is, and it will create more work for the counties, but there was just a ton of different things that we could do to make a difference.
Okay. Well, I can't speak for anybody else, but once you said Sesame Street, I personally was sold. So it sounds just terrific. Anything else, members? Representative Houseman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for letting me be part of this. I'm here.
Thank you for being here.
Of the intersection with this issue in housing. Mm. And I wanted to specifically hold up the testimony of Tanya Hanzi, the second testifier. I heard her say housing over and over, and the complexity, one, of finding stable housing, and if it's not there, what the responses are to that. You cycle back. So I would hope that in the county agenda, it's there, it's named somewhere, because it is one of those keys that
Commissioner, any response to that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Houseman and I had the pleasure of serving on a task force on housing a couple years ago. She knows that it's another one of my particular interests, because without stable housing, you have nothing for a family. It is, as you well know, it is a barrier for many people once they have a felony record or any kind of record of finding landlords willing to rent to them, let alone being able to maintain their homes. And the consequence to families of incarceration is often losing their housing, because they've, as you saw by the data, most of the parents are working at the point that they become incarcerated, and so they've suddenly lost that income. So it destabilizes the whole family. So I think you're absolutely correct. Housing and our housing policies are around people with incarceration records or who are incarcerated becomes a really critical thing. So I could get way into the weeds about some of the things that we are trying to do. Among the things we are trying in Olmsted County is we are trying a pretrial diversion program so that we incarcerate fewer people. We do a deeper risk assessment, and we've hired staff to do that, and we are incarcerating fewer people, which means a big impact on their family and also a big impact on our jail. We were at the point of, do we need a larger jail? And now at this point we're saying, no, we probably don't. We're also looking at dosage probation, which is another way to move forward with helping families move into a time of more stability, where they can focus on family and their future rather than their obligations for past misbehavior. So, we're looking at that as well. And so this piece of this work is important for the children, but how we handle our corrections offenders and what the consequences are for them in the short and long term certainly comes right back to affecting the children as well. But right, this work is focused on what can we be doing with and for the children of incarcerated caregivers.
And Chair Houseman, thank you for being here, for lifting that up, because it is such a critical issue. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That spurs another question. And can you help me, Mr. Hutton, to understand how pervasive the work release programs are in the county jails throughout Minnesota? I know there's 87 different jurisdictions, so there's maybe 87 different ways that they do work release so that they can keep their job. So 66% already have a job when they're being incarcerated, according to the studies that they just showed us. So how many of those, or how many counties have a work release program? I know Wright County does, and so I don't know who else does.
Sure, fine.
Mr. Chair, Representative, great question, but I apologize. I don't have knowledge of that. I know that we did in Washington County, and I know most of the metro counties do, but outstate, I'm sorry, I couldn't tell you. And it's run sometimes within the jail, however, significant oversight by community corrections or county community corrections.
If it's possible, maybe to gather some of that and provide it to Representative O'Neill and us, that'd be good. Representative O'Neill, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just saying that it, all this information is incredibly helpful, which is why I was so excited to see you sit there today. We could have a long conversation, yeah. You and I, but we'll do that offline. But it just helps us craft better legislation here, or even just pushing and promoting certain things that are happening. Sometimes just shining a light on that makes a big difference. But if you could get back to us on that, I know that's a big help to people. So if they already have a job, to keep a job, as long as they're not a danger to society, if you could get that, that would be so helpful. Thank you, Mr. Hutton.
Any other questions? Oh, Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank Chairs Considine and Pinto for raising this topic. It's so important. And I guess I have a comment and then also a question. You're talking about the flag of handle with care in schools. Reminds me, in the obstetric office, when someone has had a recent pregnancy loss, we flag a chart and we make sure that people don't sit in the waiting room with a bunch of pregnant women. And the whole staff and all the providers know, and we're very careful to treat that person with extra care and love and support. And it strikes me, we know so much more about ACEs now than we used to. And many of the ACEs are hidden. And this is a very public, knowable ACE, and it's one of the most impactful. It strikes me as such an opportunity for us to lift this community of children up and embrace them as a society and as a culture. So that triggered that in me, and it's that the fact that it's a knowable ACE and it's such a powerful and profound one strikes me just as an opportunity. So thank you for highlighting this.
Mr. Chair, if I could respond.
Commissioner, yeah.
Not forget,
I think she might have been moving on to a question, but a comment, please, Commissioner.
Research does show that if you have an incarcerated parent, you're likely to have several other ACEs. Mm. So it becomes a bigger flag than just that actual flag.
Even more knowable. That's good. And then Representative Morrison.
Related but not. It says on here that Ms. Hansi is involved in the prison doula project, and I just would love to hear more about that. Are you still here?
If Ms. Hansi is.
Is there time for you to share a little bit about that?
I think we can take a couple minutes on that. We've built some time at the end, and we'll cycle that around, because as long as that's been brought up, if Ms. Hansi, if you don't mind coming over, I don't know if we can make some room up there for her.
Mr. Chair,
Commissioner. Yeah, why don't we just make sure, are there any other questions for our folks from the work group? I want to thank the three of you so much, not only testimony today, but this really important work, and to answer your question about sort of how you can inform and assist us a lot. You can inform us a lot, and that will assist us a lot. So please keep in touch with us. Thank you so much, Chair. And then Ms. Hansi, why don't you come on back up, and we'll have you answer Ms. Morrison's Representative Morrison's questions, and then we'll hear from our commissioners after that.
I'd also ask that Dr. Rebecca Schlafer.
We can do that. Dr. Schlafer, why don't you come on up as well, and if you can, and then Ms. Hansi, please begin.
So I can give a little background of the Minnesota Prison Doula Project. So we're in now seven facilities, including Shakopee, and then six other county jails. We do a lot more than just support birthing people that are incarcerated, but we also do parenting class for mothers, a prenatal class, and then a mothering class. We also do peer-to-peer support, and also supportive visitation in one of our county jails. Right now, that same county jail also has us working with the men, which has been phenomenal, and we have more men that are doing supportive visitation than we do the mothers, which is to see some of the pictures and to see some of the, hear some of the stories of the men and the fathers, just it's heartbreaking, and also very, it gives you a lot of hope. I was able to be in one of the in some of the focus groups to get the men's programming started. And when we went in there, you don't really know what you're going to expect. And every one of the men brought in pictures of their children and sat around and said, "Do you see my baby? This is my baby. Do you see this? This is my baby. What are we going to be able to visit with our children?" Because most of the jails, like they talked about earlier, there's not visitation. And especially when you're talking about rural county jails, if you're not sentenced, many of them do not allow visitation with children at all. You have to be sentenced. And we know that about 70% of people that are in jail right now are not sentenced. So they can be away from their children for a much longer period of time. We are supporting women that are pregnant, that are birthing. In 2014, we were able to get the no shackling law passed in Minnesota, which has been amazing. But still, at 36 to 48 hours, these children are being separated from their mother. And it's the first time that these mothers are spending any time of their incarceration alone. Because I can tell you, as someone that was pregnant while I was incarcerated, it was the one thing that kept me going. I had to keep going because I had my baby with me. And then when that baby is separated and you don't know where that baby is, many of the women don't know, and they don't know for a long time where their baby is, if their baby's okay. In Minnesota, we're not able to do, aren't able to have a breast milk program because of some issues, which we are able to have in Alabama. So we have a sister organization in Alabama, Tutwiler Prison, where they're able to supply breast milk to their children. So,
thank you. Follow-up, Representative Morrison. I think we can take one or two more questions for these folks if anyone has them, or otherwise we'll bring up the commissioners. I might just ask one question. I'll move Dr. Schlafer back up there, which is that I was really struck by a comment of the commissioner, Commissioner Cascaden, about children craving physical contact with the parent, and just thinking about the attachment that occurs in the youngest children, which is certainly the focus of those of us in the Early Childhood Committee. And I think that physical contact is just so critical. Can you talk about these issues from that developmental perspective for the very youngest children?
Sure, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. We know that that's how physical touch is the way children and parents connect, right? We know that children, through the touch of their parents, through gentle rocking, sweet changing of a diaper, all of those physical connections between a caregiver and a baby is the way a baby is reinforced to say, I am loved, I am taken care of, my needs are being met. And that is the foundation of all, you know, that attachment relationship in the very beginning of life sets the foundation for all future social and emotional development. So I serve as the research director for the Minnesota Prison Doula Project, which is why Tanya asked me to come up here. Thinking about that, when we think about that early separation between moms and their babies, as Tanya said, 48 hours after birth, it can often take several weeks before the paperwork is in place, before that baby can come to visit at the prison. That's a really hard time for moms to be separated from their babies, but it's also developmentally really problematic for that baby. It's important to remember that most of these moms are going to be released from prison and resume parenting their babies. So this really early period where we've separated babies from their primary caregivers is really an insult to child development. And it's really problematic when we think about moms returning and being able to be there and nurturing their babies, be connected to their babies, feel connected to their babies, and their babies having not built that relationship with them. It's really difficult to do that in a prison setting. And as Tanya mentioned, the jails are really, frankly, not set up to have any kind of physical contact between children and their incarcerated parents.
Thank you. Thank you. Any other questions for our two experts here? I'm not seeing anyone. Again, thank you both on behalf of the committees for your work and testimony today. And so we'll invite the two commissioners up, and so grateful to have you both here. We've got Commissioner Malcolm listed first, though if for any reason you want to take a different order, you're certainly welcome to. And so, Commissioner, we'll have you just introduce yourself for the record, and please proceed with your comments. So glad to have you here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you so much. My name is Jan Malcolm. I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Health. And it's my great pleasure to be here with my colleague, Commissioner Schnell, today. But I just want to say thank you also to Chair Pinto, Chair Considine, for having this, what I understand is a rather unusual joint gathering of these two committees. It's brilliant. I mean, I think you've pointed out and you've heard from Dr. Schlafer just outstanding analysis of the data. And I just want to thank Dr. Schlafer and Ms. Hanzi. I really want to thank you mm-hmm. for your just powerful testimony, insightful and courageous. So thank you for sharing. What you're doing here, the conversation you've just been having about the intersection of these issues, early childhood, corrections, housing, I'm here to represent public health, grateful to the leaders that you just saw, Sheriff Hutton, Commissioner Sheila Kiskaden, who is one of our most active members of the statewide Community Health Services Advisory Committee, known to us in lovingly in public health as SHAC. So when you hear us talk about SHAC, it is this wonderful structure we have between state and local governmental public health agencies to coordinate policy about how to actually improve health in our state. So I just wanted to share a few more thoughts with you about why is this a public health issue? I think Dr. Schlaefer nailed it in her testimony. She shared with you the data that indicates how powerful an influence on the health of children the incarceration of their parents is, how that shows up in their educational outcomes and in their health outcomes while they are children, but going on throughout their lifespan. In the Health and Human Services Committee, and I know just a few of you are also members of Health and Human Services, either on the policy or finance side, we talk all the time about how are we going to get better health outcomes for Minnesotans at a cost that we can sustain for state government, for local governments, for businesses, and most importantly, for families and individuals in Minnesota. And we talk a lot in Health and Human Services about the mismatch between where we spend our time and our money and where the opportunity is to get better outcomes for our state. And the fact that we, that old saying, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, we ought to revisit that because that is true, and it's not what we do in terms of our allocation of policy attention or resources. And I think what you just heard here is such a beautiful example of the kind of thinking we're going to have to do to come at these problems and these opportunities in a more holistic way, understanding how these systems relate to each other and really figuring out what does it mean to work on prevention at a systemic level. You know, we most of the time in Health and Human Services, we spend worrying about making sure that people get access to good medical care. And heaven knows that is critical. Not for a minute suggesting that we can improve health without good medical care. But too often the conversation kind of stops there. You know, are people getting the care they need? We've known for a long time that there are other things that are powerful influences on people's health. Certainly, and very importantly, the choices we make as individuals about the health risks that we can control, what we choose to do with our own health behaviors, that we've known for a long time. What's more recent in our understanding, maybe not our conceptual understanding, but the data has absolutely exploded in the last 10 years or so about the impact of conditions in families and communities on health. That we know so much more now about the fact that the conditions in our communities and our families absolutely overwhelm the ability of health care to produce better outcomes. So we're chasing our tails, you know, in circles and circles if all we do is worry about how to fund interventions after the fact and don't do everything we can do to understand where are the opportunities for intervention earlier, prevention, going upstream, as we like to talk about in public health. And what I just so appreciated about the conversation the committees were just having with the witnesses today was you saw really good examples of where some of those levers are and how truly systemic they are and how powerful those system redesigns could be in giving people actual, like realistic, better chances to make healthier choices. That's what we all want, is for people to have the agency and have the information and have the support to make better choices, because our choices are hugely important to our health and to the sustainability of our system. But we don't make choices in a vacuum. We make choices in the context of what opportunities do or don't exist for us to make healthier choices. I'm sure in your committees, in all committees, and I think it's a wonderful thing that we in Minnesota are starting to really tackle the differences in outcomes, whether we're talking educational or economic success or health, the fact that, you know, on average, we do a wonderful job in Minnesota. And underneath those averages, we have really, really big disparities and structural inequities in whether all people really can be healthy or not. So I just think this issue and really drilling into the specifics about And I just want to end by agreeing strongly with Dr. Schlafer and with the SHAC work group that the children of incarcerated parents represent a really interesting opportunity and a very focused group of people, of children and their parents, that would really be a win-win, given what we know about the concentration of the negative experiences that they're having, the predictive value of those ACEs on their health. What a great way to really kind of follow the data and follow some of these insights about, you know, kind of the systemic nature of some of these problems to really produce some win-wins, to get better health outcomes, better educational outcomes, better economic development outcomes, better corrections and justice outcomes. If we take this this look that you are taking here today, I just again want to say thank you for making the time for this cross-jurisdictional conversation. And we in Health and Human Services want to be right there with you. So thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Commissioner. Really appreciate it. And Commissioner Schnell.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Paul Schnell. I'm the Commissioner of Corrections. I want to thank you also for this opportunity and the opportunity to spend some time with my colleague, Commissioner Malcolm, and as was stated, the importance of this topic. As you've already heard, Minnesota has the substantial majority of prisoners in our state have minor children, most of whom lived with their children prior to their arrest. The experts who've testified already provided stunning data that illustrates the depth of the problems we face. That parental incarceration has consequences for children and their families. It may confer risk through a number of mechanisms, including the disruption in their relationships, the challenges with parenting, economic instability, and residential mobility. While we're specifically talking about incarceration today, I want to take this opportunity to remind us all that incarceration is not a single discrete event, but a dynamic process that children experience over a spectrum and over time. Many of the children we talk about today whose parents are incarcerated also witnessed their parents' arrests. Prior to my time in this role and the many years I served as a police officer and investigator, I removed children from their parents many times. Even when it was necessary, it was no less heart-wrenching to do that. To us, this involvement in the involvement in the criminal justice system. For children, the impact is the same as any other involuntary or sudden separation from a parent. The pain, the grief, the confusion are no different than losing a parent to death or separation from a parent in a different way. The DOC, we've been prioritizing how to make changes within the correction system to better serve the whole of family needs. We're assessing our visitation policies down to concrete things like how our visiting rooms are set up and how we process applications, as was pointed out, sometimes very delayed. And we're partnering with the experts and sometimes getting pressure from the experts, which we need, to understand how we make things better. Two of the most incredible and challenging conversations I've had over the past year has been the time I spend with family members of crime victims. And the second group is the time I spend with moms who've given birth while they've been incarcerated. And having their baby taken from them and given to a family member, only for them to be transported back to prison and undergo the standard rigors of strip search upon return to prison. As a dad myself, I can't imagine what that would be like. Well, many may listen to this and say, if you can't do the crime, you shouldn't do the crime. Can't do the crime, you shouldn't do the crime. Such characterizations are not the whole story. When we consider that women who give birth during incarceration are with us on a short-term basis, usually well less than a year, we must ask the bigger question, what objective do we seek to achieve? The stories from incarcerated parents are certainly not limited to moms. I've heard stories from incarcerated dads who use their phone time, the time that they pay for, at 5 cents a minute. To call their children to read to them at the end of each day and to help their children with their homework. It's important to note also that the single most requested prison program is parenting. That's the good news. The bad news is that we have far greater demand than we have current capacity. As Dr. Schlaefer mentioned, we don't often think about this component of the criminal justice response and its implication on parenting and future success of the children of incarcerated parents. Just last week, a man incarcerated at Stillwater mentioned that he is enrolling in a facility-offered educational program. He went on to explain that he made that decision despite the implication that he would make less money than in his current role working in the prison industry program. But he felt it was critical to model the value of education and its many benefits versus the short-term gain of an extra 25 or 50 cents per hour. In community-based program meetings with family members of incarcerated people, including their children, I cannot tell you how hard it is to explain the limitations that get placed on parent-child bonding by the system or the institutional demands that we face. Namely, our prisons, and in fact our entire system, are not known for providing opportunity for more deeply to allow parents and children to more deeply connect. Visits are often time and, frankly, activity limited. In the hundreds and hundreds of conversations I've had with women and men in our prisons, never, not once, has an incarcerated person wished for their child to follow their footsteps. Even those who continue to struggle in the criminal justice involvement or reinvolvement, they wish a different outcome for their kids. Even if our collective state objective is for accountability, as a state and as a society, it should be our objective not to cause harm to the children of those who are affected, the children of system-involved people who are often impacted. In this room today sits many of us who come from homes where there was alcoholism or addiction or family violence. These experiences often go untold because of the shame that we can experience as a result of them. One can only imagine the shame, the increased levels of shame for incarcerated parents, and as has been described, for their children. I believe that we can enact policy that meets the state's penal objectives and still find concrete ways to support parent-child relationships. As we speak, the Department of Corrections is working with our partners to establish policies that require an analysis of the implications of a supervised release violation or possible return to prison on the system-involved person's employment, their housing, and importantly, their family. We feel that requiring this assessment addresses all components of that system-involved person's life because we must see that person as more than the worst thing they've ever done. I'm grateful for the opportunity to meet with you today, and I surely can't underestimate the value of early childhood programming for the good and welfare of all children, my own included. But it would be wrong to underestimate the especially important impact that early childhood programming has on those who need it most. The children of incarcerated parents being one of them. Thank you.
Thank you to both commissioners. I know that Representative Tabke had a question. Representative Tabke.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Schnell, I have a question for you. I'm, just so everyone knows, I'm the state rep for Shakopee, where the women's prison is. And over the course of the last few years, you've done a tremendous job of improving the visitation area for interaction between the parent, the mothers and children there, and having really focusing a lot on what we've talked about today. But as I visit other prisons with St. Cloud and Stillwater, it's a starkly different atmosphere in the visitation areas. for the fathers of children. And so I'm just curious as to what the future plans are for those areas as to really focus on these issues we've been talking about today and the ability to have inviting warm places for children to visit their fathers and have similar experiences as they are with mothers within the corrections system.
Commissioner Schnell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tappy, thank you. Yes, we are having conversations. Each of the wardens at all of our correctional facilities have been tasked with trying to create and identify a space that is more child friendly, especially for younger children, and for to find space as limited as that can be in many of our older facilities. Even in Shakopee, we find that space is limited, but we think it's essential that we provide and create a mechanism for children and their parents to even as much get down on the floor and do what most of us do when we're playing with our kids when they're young, and so each of them have been asked to identify a plan. While space is limited, we think that there are some things we can do just even with changing the color of the environment, a little bit of designated space, some access to certain kinds of toys or play items. These are just things that we're trying to work out. It will never be a living room, unfortunately, but within our facilities, we think it's critical that we each facility have a space for that.
Thank you.
Representative Wasilewicz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if one of the things that came up in the conversation today was thinking about sentencing alternatives, so ways that we can keep families connected to one another, perhaps by not having folks incarcerated in the first place. I'm wondering if you could speak to some of the, you know, what that program looks like. I think it's been said that it's mostly for nonviolent offenders, but if you can speak to kind of the guidelines for that or what it looks like in terms of ensuring the relationship between the parent and child, but also the safety of the child.
Commissioner Schnell.
Thank you. One of the proposals that we intend to be bringing into the next upcoming legislative session starting next week is really proposals that do begin to address some of that. In particular, focusing a little bit on the number of women who come into our prisons and are pregnant or just gave birth immediately prior to. In most instances, these women are coming into prison and oftentimes months that they're going to be there. And so what we're doing is we bring them in. They may work with the doula project. They on prenatal sorts of things, they will have their child and, as was mentioned, be brought back into prison. That child may go with many times another caregiver, grandparent. We feel that there are ways for us to begin to address that, and we want to explore some really creative options for those people who have these periods of time where they either just gave birth or are about to give birth. Can we look at the use of community-based halfway house options? Could we even look at adult foster care options so that these women are provided with the kinds of support that they need? Ultimately, to serve the objective of some accountability, and oftentimes that accountability is really about doing well, because especially when we're talking about really a large percentage of our population, these nonviolent offenders, this is not necessarily about serving long sentences for violent crimes. We're talking oftentimes about people who may be sent back to prison oftentimes for 2 or 3 or 4 months because of a technical violation. Oftentimes their own family circumstances are such that they weren't able to make their probation officer visits. And ultimately that resulted in a revocation and a return to prison. And during that course of time, we think it would be best that we maximize support, wrap around them, hold them accountable to that, and ultimately it serves both the best interest of them and the best interest of their children, which I think ultimately serves the broader community and state's objective of wanting to see people do the right thing.
Other questions from members? Representative Hausman.
Mr. Chair, I've been sitting here ever since that earlier question triggered information from the front table that I found so shocking, and that is that Alabama has figured out how to handle the breast milk thing and we can't. I mean, that seems kind of basic for the two commissioners there. I'll bet they'll solve that in 5 minutes.
Commissioners, five minute solution? That's about how much time we have left, so that's perfect. Commissioner Schnell.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can say by Friday we will have that solved. We have been working on this issue. It's an issue of policy in terms of storage and those sorts of things, but not things that are crazy. So we will have this finalized, done, and completed so that can happen.
Good. We are pleased, Commissioner Schnell. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to thank the testifiers now and the previous testifiers, too, for this area and lifting it up, our awareness. And I read your talking points, so it's a complex problem. But, you know, one thing that I've learned today is that when we're talking about these children, especially the youngest children, the newborns, which is just astounding to me. We're talking about a group of people that our state is not serving well. There's the Second Chance Coalition, but these children have been denied a first chance. And it's just very, very powerful, and thank you for the work that you're doing with us. Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Schnell, you made reference to there being at least one proposal, maybe some others that you expect to be advancing this session. And this establishes kind of a baseline knowledge for us, but anything that you want to say real briefly about that? I know we have a question from Representative Bonner, but I guess I just want to confirm it sounds likely that there'll be some proposals that may be coming from the department in this area.
Mr. Chair and members, yes, we will be bringing a number of proposals forward that we think will address a range of these issues.
Okay, good. Thank you. Representative Bonner, we're going to give you the last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the commissioners. You know, I think I'm struggling with this a little bit because we're talking about parents, and to your point, who to some degree haven't even had a first chance. I mean, I think one of the things we've done with the Early Childhood Committee, we've had considerable testimony and discussion about the importance of bonding with your child, the amount of brain development that happens even in the first few years of life, and how that impacts that child's intellect, their physical, emotional abilities going forward in life, to do well in school, to perhaps take a different path that their parents might wish for them. And I know that we also discussed that there are some, in many cases, where these are short-term arrangements, but we have a child separated from a parent at a really critical phase of life. And I will tell you in full disclosure that as I sit here listening to this, not only am I extremely troubled, I feel knots in my stomach thinking about these babies being separated from their parents at a time that is just so critical for them and their development. It makes me sick to think about that. And I know that we are talking a little bit here more about other options for these newly or mothers who've just newly given birth. And I guess if there's any other thoughts you can share about those ideas, certainly I would love to hear them. I know that this just seems extremely troubling to me when we consider the implications down the road. And we also know that folks who are in prison or who have been incarcerated, that when they have a connection to their family and to the community, they are far less likely to reoffend and get into trouble again. And so those two items would be great if you could address them.
Any final comments, commissioners? Commissioner Schnell.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you. I understand that not, because I've certainly felt it when I have listened to these stories, and certainly as someone who represents that component of the system, it's challenging. I think there are things, you know, that we can do. Even we talk about things like, I know that the connection can mean a lot of different things. Even things like phone calls with you know, your 3- and 4- and 2-year-olds are things that can become difficult because, again, these become costs for these families. And I think part of this really is grounded in a paradigm, and I think we'll talk more about this certainly in the upcoming session. But when I talk to some of the members of the Department of Corrections and who are still working today, and they talk about what happened in Shakopee, that there was a day when there was an entire unit at Shakopee where moms and their children could be together, stay together in a unit. This is not ancient history. This is within the last 20 to 25 years. And I think it shows the progression of the orientation, the paradigm that we've moved toward as we think about the way we respond to people's involvement in wrongdoing in the community, that ultimately it became that first and at all expense and without thought to this. There was a time at Stillwater when on Saturdays families could come and visit and they could actually barbecue in the yard with their families. Again, this is within the last 25 years. And today it seems totally absurd that that would happen. And yet within the last 25 years, within the last generation, there were people where that kind of stuff was possible, where it could be done with safety as an orientation, with safety as a clear and critical objective, but not at the expense of the loss of connection when we know that 95% of these people are going to come right back into our communities and be our neighbors. It seems to me something that all of us should be interested in is thinking about how it is that we build and strengthen connections with and among the people who are incarcerated, their families, and certainly that we build stronger community around all of these folks.
Thank you. Thank you so much to both the commissioners, to our testifiers. Thank you, members, for taking the time this afternoon outside of session. This is a really important topic, and I know we'll be discussing it more. With that, members, please make sure to turn in your blue forms. We get those signed. With that, we are adjourned.